Shortly after UK currency was decimalised, which to me seems like yesterday, but shock horror, was in reality 1971. And when those of us who lived through it were recalibrating ourselves with the new, while still mourning the comforting familiarities of the old, I was tempted by a colleague to make my inaugural visit into a betting shop. Here, under his avuncular guidance, I laid a stake for the equivalent of the old 2 shillings and sixpence, or 12.5 new pence. Imagine my unalloyed joy when some three-legged nag I picked with a pin crossed the line first, and I was rewarded with the life-changing sum of 10 shillings and sixpence, by then better known as 52.5 new pence. Lo, here endeth my first and only experience in a bookies, since over half a lifetime down the line I still take smoke satisfaction in being one of the few who have made a killing, taken their winnings and run, never to return. From which it may reasonably be presumed that I am not a gambling man. Even so, I am prepared to lay a sizeable wager that a snippet of news relegated to the inside pages by dint of one continent bursting into flames whilst another drowns under a biblical deluge will someday be seen as a symbolic point of reference in the perpetual evolution of our language. In early December 2019, it was announced that a society dedicated to preserving the, quote, much abused apostrophe, was to be disbanded. John Richards, who worked in journalism for much of his career, started the Apostrophe Protection Society in 2001 after he retired. Calling it a day, he wrote on his website, "Fewer organisations and individuals are now caring about the correct use of the apostrophe in the English language. We and our many supporters worldwide have done our best, but the ignorance and laziness present in modern times have won." Lest we think this is all too inconsequential, and so what? It was a blockbusting little tome of 2003 by literary editor and broadcaster Lynn Truss that illustrated the importance of apostrophes, commas, colons, semicolons and other grammatical ticks to an audience that, judging by the sales, was ravenous for redemption. The title of the book, Eats, Shoots and Leaves, the Zero Tolerance Approach to Punctuation, is a syntactic ambiguity, that is, a verbal fallacy arising from an ambiguous or erroneous grammatical construction, and is derived from a joke about bad punctuation as explained on the back cover thus, slightly paraphrased. A panda walks into a cafe. He orders a sandwich, eats it, then draws a gun and fires 2 shots in the air. As the panda makes towards the exit, he drops a badly punctuated wildlife manual, and the waiter turns to the relevant entry to find an explanation for this strange behaviour. Panda, large black and white bear-like mammal, native to China, eats, shoots and leaves. Groan. To be brutally honest, the book itself needed the services of a ruthless editor, and I feel the point was adequately made long before I was a quarter of the way through, but hey, it sold in numbers I could never dream of for my modest scribblings, so I'll do the noble thing by not tainting the basket with the taste of my sour grapes. Anyway, the point is, the proper use of language should start with schools and parenting, but will endure through life by the reading of well-written books in whatever format of electronic or hard copy they nowadays take. And therein lies the problem. Only the scrupulous editor, fastidious proofreader, or judicious reviewer, whom by definition must, unlike the casual reader, go through the work with a fine tooth comb, only they know just how badly many books are written. Ah, now, I can see the barred slings and arrows of outrageous fortune being turned in my direction to repel incursions of intellectual snobbishness, but please hang fire and don't shoot the messenger just yet. Our wonderful language is constantly morphing. Witness the number of words annually included in and dropped from that bastion of grammar and usage, the Oxford English Dictionary. Old words become outmoded or unfashionable, whilst new ones, particularly those associated with rapid changes in technology, run the gamut from slang or vernacular to mainstream, along with the punctuation that helps steer their interpretation. Many survive the course over the long term, and it is said that someone familiar with the Black Country dialect is well equipped to tackle Chaucer, author of the Canterbury Tales, who is considered as critical in legitimising the use of Middle English. Right now, I have in front of me a small library of books defining long-abandoned words and grammar. I relish them and occasionally bring one or two examples out of retirement to re-employ in my musings, not so much for effect, but more an act of rebellion against their devaluation. Let's be honest, the 16th century pilled garlic is infinitely more colourful than its mundane contemporary analogue of bald-headed. Of course, I recognise that our language is constantly evolving, and I do not stand King Canute-like resisting its march. It's more the case of finding a certain reassurance in the robustness of the time served, yet equally, I'm amongst the first to welcome how our language transmutes with time and circumstances. And, taking a lump hammer to further crack the veneer of pretension, patois, dialect and poetic licence all play their part. Lewis Carroll's 19th century masterpiece of nonsense, Jabberwocky, is an object lesson in how to mangle our native tongue. In 2016, Soul of Bones by Mike McCormack, an entire book written as a single sentence, won the Goldsmith Prize for fiction that breaks the mould or opens up new possibilities in the novel form. Even the aforementioned Bard himself used the technique of emphasis created by grammatical anomalies, as in, parting is such sweet sorrow. Sorrow? Sweet? Really? All notable, though all grammatically incorrect, in the usually accepted sense. Which is what exactly? Well, let's begin to answer that one by asserting that a prerequisite for any language is a structure in which the message is directed from a transmitter to a receiver to effectively convey the same meaning as were formulated by the transmitter. To achieve this without a mutually understood structure is all but impossible. It's as if we are communicating in different languages or different variations of the same language. Which, in fact, we are. Riding the hinterland between nebulous thought and accurate expression is unforgiving territory. The structure may not immediately be apparent, but it is nonetheless there. The Unwinese gobbledygook of the late self-styled Professor Stanley Unwin was impenetrable, but became more coherent when he explained his rules for concocting it. Et voila! He had a structure for his zany comedic language that transgressed negligence of its own parameters. And therein lies the crux, in exactly the same way that Tommy Cooper could mess up his magic tricks to hilarious effect only because he knew how to do them properly in the first place. He was a leading light in the magic circle. I contend that it is possible to safely deviate from the rules of grammar only when one first knows how to skillfully navigate them. Similarly, compare and contrast the distinction between the practice of dropping apostrophes at, say, King's Cross or the Regent's Canal, with blatant misuse when they are thrown in arbitrarily or left out erroneously, and we begin to identify a distinction between fashionable idleness and unpardonable illiteracy. Or indeed, personal preference. Parliamentarian Rebecca Long Bailey publicly declares she doesn't mind whether her Long and Bailey are hyphenated or not, as long as they're both there. Whilst actress Helena Bonham Carter says her Bonham Carter hyphen is optional. Then there are developments that oblige us to bend the rules whether we want to or not. A hyphen, in techno-speak, must sometimes be represented as an underscore, otherwise, as comedian David Walliams said in his prescient Little Britain parody, Computer Says No. All of this perplexes me daily, since I live in Drover's Barn, spelt with no apostrophe. A charming idiosyncrasy that has its own sense of licence and at no great loss to its meaning. I ponder whether it is named by a predecessor with a sense of grammatic experimentalism, or the possessor of a lamentable measure of ignorance, or personal preference. In all cases, it's grammatically incorrect. Then I realise that few who visit even notice, let alone comment, and I understand the dissolution of the Apostrophe Society. And I fear it is my sad duty to suggest it is not just the poor apostrophe. The battle is far from over, as our grammatical regimen is increasingly mauled by the rise of, take a guess, yes, social media. Demanding little attention span and requiring even less consideration to detail, it is a prime mover in the trend to shout in capitals, representing repetitive volume rather than convince by considered persuasion. Behind every good writer lies an even better editor, yet modern social media enables one to become their own moderator when neither qualified nor competent to do so. Inane abbreviations and puerile emoticons compound downward pressure, and the patina of trust from messages sent or retweeted from those we already know gives strength to the perpetuation and acceptance of errors. Amongst these, the rubrics of good syntax and accurate punctuation are just plain inconvenient. So then, having acknowledged that language will evolve, does it matter that we should trouble to constrain it within a universally accepted structure? In September 1999, after almost 10 months travelling to Mars, and when NASA scientists were on tenterhooks with anticipated discoveries on the Red Planet, the eponymous and hugely expensive Mars Climate Orbiter plunged into the atmosphere and was destroyed. The reason? Someone had programmed the thrusters using the wrong units of measurement. A cartoon of the time showed a smashed spaceship on the Martian surface with a sardonic caption, metric, English, whatever. It might just as pertinently have said, eat shoots and leaves, please review before liftoff. But why quibble when we can instead bask in the judgment of luminaries such as John C. Wells, Professor Emeritus of Phonetics at University College London and former President of the English Spelling Society. Honestly, you just couldn't make that one up. Who, in a proclamation that must have been a dagger in the heart of John Richards, albeit being berated by then Prime Minister David Cameron, described the apostrophe as a waste of time. Ah well, for those less enlightened who persist in defending anachronistic convictions, there will always be the protective firewall of disparaging humour. And, as they say in these parts, complete with apostrophe, there's lovely. Now that's satire.